four.
Three, four.
The whole course of this bit of instruction at Dover was to converting onto monoplanes. Simply this: you first qualified on the Penguin for taxiing, you then qualified on your Virgin for straights, you then went up with the instructor in an ordinary dual control Blériot and did your stuff in the air, which was mostly circuits and bumps, as it would be in anything else. But in this case, I ran across a most unfortunate one with the Virgin, which put paid not only to my conversion but to other chaps' conversions as well, which gave them very reasonable justification for being a bit mad about it. What actually happened was this. Having done a few straights and got a bit bored with doing straights in a Virgin, I don't know whether I might have been out for a bit of a height record and getting 8 feet instead of only six or something like that. But I left my engine on a tiny touch longer than I should have done. And so when I throttled back, came down to land, I rolled on and rolled on and rolled on, and you mustn't forget that we hadn't got any brakes. Brakes weren't thought of in aircraft for some extraordinary reason for another 20 or 30 years. Rolled on and rolled on, straight ahead into the barbed wire fence at the end of the aerodrome, up onto my nose, broke the prop and what have you. And my instructor, Marsh, was the maddest man. Very naturally, I didn't appreciate what I'd done. I didn't appreciate that I'd held up the whole works by doing this. But he was the maddest man I wanted to see for a long time. And he said that that machine will go into the hangar and I will get onto the telephone right, left and centre and I will procure from somewhere a new prop, whether there were any in this country or there weren't, and I would see them get it, and until that machine was functioning again, I would sleep under that machine in the hangar, and that was that. Well, there were no shop stewards and there was no pilots' trade union in these days, and so when an instructor said, you'll sleep under that machine in the hangar, you jolly well had to do. But that brought another thing, which was that when it came closer on, I got my bedding roll stuck in under the wing in the cold tarmac in the hangar, and then it occurred to me that a sweetie was coming over from Folkestone, and I was meeting a sweetie in Dover that evening, and what was I going to do? It then occurred to me that although I'd been sentenced to this awful punishment, CB, confined to barracks, had not been included in the sentence. And as I was not confined to barracks, there was no earthly reason why I should not go down and meet the floozy in Dover as arranged, which I did. In due course, she wanted to be taken home to her mother in Folkestone, which was the normal end of the evening to do, and that meant upsetting these arrangements altogether. And so the only thing I could do, if I was going to take her going back to Folkestone, I must, at this stage, get permission from Marsh to do it. Well, the rest of the story I picked up when I got back to Dover aerodrome the following morning. What had happened was, in the middle of mess that night, an orderly had come into the room and told Captain Marsh that he was wanted on the telephone. Marsh went out to answer the telephone, came back to the mess fuming, and said, you know that little squirt Shabbo broke the Blériot today, gets me on the telephone, and he said he's got to see some floozy back to Folkestone, and he says, please, sir, must I sleep under the Virgin tonight? I quite agree.
Were there any repercussions from this affair?
Oh, yes, indeed. It really was not as light an incident as it happened, as it sounds like. It simply meant that by putting this Blériot out of action, what I had done was obstruct the whole course of converting people, biplane people, onto monoplanes. And that is to say, it obstructed the whole course of feeding the fighter squadrons with new fighter pilots. And also, I'd done the same with myself, because the next day, there being no avenue now for furthering the conversion onto biplanes, onto monoplanes, I was transferred to monoplanes, and so then eventually, when I left Dover, went out to biplane squadron instead of into one of the fighter squadrons.
So, but for this incident, you might have been a fighter pilot.
It altered the whole jolly lot of my whole RFC, RAF career.
Before you were now transferred to B2Cs, did you fly any other aircraft while you were at Dover?
Yes, either before I went onto the 2Cs or during the time I was onto 2Cs, I'm not quite sure, but the moment arose when there was a BE-8, an old bloater, to be collected from Farnborough, because bloater was also used in Dover. And I was detailed to go to Farnborough and pick it up. So after Farnborough, I went to pick this thing up. Incidentally, quite a thing which is worth remembering. Farnborough was so packed with people that I stayed at an hotel overnight while the machine was getting ready, and I actually slept on the billiard table of the hotel that I stayed at, because there was no other accommodation in Farnborough at all. That's what Farnborough was like. But having slept on the billiard table, I picked up the bloater, which I was to take back to Dover. Now then, it just happened that this bloater was a bit of a special. The reason being this: there had been quite a lot of fabric failure over in France and in all the early aircraft. I have seen machines, after spending a bit of time in there, come down with their fabric in tatters. I don't mean completely in tatters, but giving way. And this could be very dangerous. In fact, it had turned out to be very dangerous at various times, and so it was one of the things which Farnborough was engaged in looking into, strengthening up in some sort of way the fabric. It was a linen fabric, of course, doped. Strengthening up in some way, or stopping the deterioration which was happening in fabric. And this bloater, which I was picking up, was one of their experimental jobs. And the experiment they were trying on this particular job was painting it all over with brilliant white paint, the idea being that it would reflect light, and hence, if actual light was one of the reasons for the deterioration of the fabric, it would be picked up. They could watch the progress of this bloater after she was delivered, and it could let them know whether the reflecting away of the light from the fabric was having any sort of an effect on the stability of the fabric or not. And so this was rather a special. Right, off I went from Farnborough. Got down to Dover. When I got to Dover, it was under cloud. I had passed over Folkestone on the way, naturally, and I knew that in Folkestone, well, anyone who knows it, in Folkestone is a jolly big race course. As I couldn't get into Dover owing to the low cloud sitting on top of the hills, back I went to Folkestone and perched the old bloater in Folkestone overnight. It was sometime in the afternoon that I took it down. a funny one happened at Folkestone. It just happened that one of the very first contingents of Canadians had just arrived, and they were camping or installed, whatever the word is, on Folkestone Aerodrome. And first they saw this strange-looking... People weren't accustomed to seeing aeroplanes flying around in the sky, and once, if an aeroplane came flying around in the sky, it was something unusual and different. And I had wandered around Folkestone Racecourse two or three times looking for the best perch to land on, and this had filled the Canadians with an idea that I was spying out the land. And when I came in and landed, I was told to report to the office, and they reported to the office, and they said, "Well, your papers to support your story." I had not any papers, because one of the things that we always were was drilled into us, that if we were doing any sort of a cross country, which we might have any possibility of going astray, you must never carry any sort of papers with you. And so on this particular job, I had no papers to prove who I was. I told him who I was and where I came from and so on. But that wouldn't satisfy these Canadians who were all out for blood. They didn't actually get any blood, but they put me in a cabin and shut me up there while they made inquiries. When they'd finished making their inquiries, they decided, I told them they could get on to Dover and that sort of thing. When they finished making their inquiries, they decided that I wasn't a spy, they thought I was. And but then it was too late to go on. So I went on the following morning out to Dover, and I found that still was low stuff over the hill, but it didn't look. It looked as if it was possibly might have been a space between the cloud and the ground. So I went out to. I wanted to get home. I went out to sea with the idea of finding my way under the cloud, if it was possible to get in under the cloud and land it on Dover. Right. So out I went about halfway across the channel and started flying in. It's true enough, there was a gap. There was a space underneath the cloud sufficient to fly in. And I was making my way to Dover when, bumf, out went the engine. Complete engine cut. Well, there's only one thing to do when you're sitting over the channel and you have an engine cut, and that is to come down and sit on the channel. and so that is what I did. And it was quite an interesting experience. She floated on her bottom planes for a little while, and the bottom planes gradually filled. And she then said the bottom planes went down, and she was resting on her top planes. But I saw that I'd got to swim for it or do something, and here a most awkward thing happened. While I'd been on my way to collect this thing from Farnborough, I had stayed in town overnight. And in town overnight, I had bought myself a new pair of boots. Now, the thing to do in those days was to wear knee-length boots, and your knee-length boots, if they wear anything at all, were very closely, tightly fitting round the knee, just below the knee. And mine were marvellous ones. But those sort of boots are all right when you've got an orderly to help you off with them at home. But when you're sitting in an aircraft in the middle of the channel with these beastly boots, getting them off is not funny at all. And to cut a long story short, even by wedging the heel of the boot in against the rudder bar and that sort of thing, I couldn't get the darn things off. And swimming in the channel with knee-length boots on didn't sound at all funny, but fortunately, I wondered whether I was going to see myself drowning at the bottom of the channel as a result of my conceit in these very, very smart knee-length boots. But there was a chuff-chuff noise, and a Navy steam pinnace came stuffing out from Dover. They had seen, of course, somebody had seen this aircraft come down in the channel. And before the top plane got completely waterlogged, the pinnace had blown up and thrown me a rope, and that was that. I went over the side and tied the rope onto the prop or onto the tail, I forget which, tied the rope on somewhere, and the pinnace with myself on board and the bloater, appropriately enough, in tow, proceeded back into Dover Harbour.
Now, after this experience with the BEA, you went back to training on B2Cs, biplanes again.
Yes.
Tell me how you found them as airplanes. Yes. Did you enjoy them?
Yes. Now then, I think the opinion about B2Cs is pretty well the same amongst people who flew them much, which is this, that the B2C had been developed. It was recognized that pilots had got to be trained quickly and not with a great deal of experience, and so an aircraft was needed which would be simple to fly. And de Havilland and who, I've forgotten, between them, had done a lot of experimentation, and between them they had produced the B2C. The characteristic of the B2C was that it was the first aircraft to be really inherently stable. The dihedral to the wings and a dihedral between the main planes and the tailplane. The dihedral on the wings gave it lateral stability. The dihedral between at which the tailplane was set in relation to the main planes gave it fore and aft stability. The fore and aft stability was not as much as the lateral stability. Lateral stability was very strong indeed, would correct anything by itself. But there it was, a very stable aircraft. Now this had, from the flying point of view, had the very great disadvantage that as the machine wanted to stay on a level keel right way up, it was very difficult to make it do anything else. And so steep turns, you could steep turn, but you wanted strong effort to put a steep turn onto a B2C compared with putting a steep turn onto anything else which was in circulation at the time. And this matter of automatic stability is quite a thing, because having got themselves into the habit of turning